Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks so much for tuning in as we continue to dig through the big old box of baseball cards. Yes, the monster box. It was pretty monstrous, but now that we've gone through all these sets all these years throughout the 1980s, it seems to get bigger, doesn't it? Yes, we're in the late 80s, 1988 to be exact, and you can definitely see the gluttony of baseball cards at this point in time as we get to 1988. And certainly in 1989, we will experience it as all the card companies had something coming out and then subsets to subsets and just way too much. But still, quite a few good memories and stories to tell from all of these older card sets. And this time around, we're looking at the 88 top set, our random pull, Glenn Davis, card number 430. No, all you young kids out there, not Big Baby Glenn Davis, not the basketball player. No, this is Glenn Davis, the baseball player. And it's so funny. Last time we did a podcast, our random pull was Will Clark. It was the 88 Fleer podcast. And I remember saying that Will Clark was a pretty underrated guy. You know, here we are years from when he made his major league debut, and he kind of gets lost in the shuffle. Well, Glenn Davis, back in the late 80s, was one of the most feared hitters, one of the most powerful first basemen in Major League Baseball. But alas, injuries and being involved in quite possibly one of the worst trades in Baltimore Orioles history has certainly put Glenn Davis well under the radar. I'm sure Orioles fans would like to bury him under the radar if they can. You've got your shovels ready. I know that's the fact. But Glenn is actually doing just fine right now, thank you. We'll tell you more about him and our look at the 88 top set, a set that I'm trying to come around to. All these years later, I'm trying to like it, but I'm still kind of repelled by it. We'll talk about that in just a moment. First, what are you talking about? Well, let's take a look at our Twitter feed, at Wax and Gum Stains. Please share our Twitter feed to anybody who you know who collects or who follows along this podcast. We love having the conversations here. And I'll make the plea once again. Think of one person in your life who collects now or did collect once upon a time and tell them about Wax and Gum Stains, the Twitter feed for Wax Ecstatic. I bet you they're going to like it as much as you do. Now, talking about the 88 Fleer podcast, I'm not the only one who likes Will Clark and what he brought to the game. Even though he wasn't necessarily known for his power hitting, he could hit home runs, though. He's certainly a very consistent batter all throughout his time, even up to his last days in St. Louis in the 2000 season. Stretch, who I believe is a Cardinals fan, my childhood hero. Yeah, all right. Will Clark got a winner there. There you go. Ken Kinsley chiming in. Not forgotten here after Dale Murphy retired. The thrill was my man. What a beautiful swing. And he had a very pure and clean swing. No doubt about that. Also, Kevin Hickerson. Clark was my idol. Favorite Clark card was 89 tops. Pure badass look. And I had to Google it again because I know I have it somewhere, but I had to look at the picture again. And there's Will Clark, again, in the batter's box, in the on-deck circle, much like 88 Fleer, but where 88 Fleer, he's putting pine tar on the bat, 89 tops. He's down on one knee, leaning on the bat, just kind of looking at the bat or looking at the pitcher and sizing up what type of pitches he was going to get. And you're right, Kevin, absolute badass look there. Pretty nice. Ben Adams adding to the mix here. The 30 for 30 on him and Palmeiro was pretty good. This must have been one of the mini 30 for 30s, one of the web-only 30 for 30s, because I haven't seen it. I'm going to look for it, though, because as it is well known, and as we mentioned in our podcast, even though Clark was often Palmeiro's shadow, wherever Rafi went, Will would go after Rafi left. They were not best of friends, even though they were teammates at Mississippi State. They were not best of friends, two completely different types of personalities, and certainly how they handled things, polar opposites in many ways. But even though you had the PED allegations and, well, guilty test for Palmeiro back in the day, two of the most unbelievable hitters. It would have been amazing if you could have had them on the same team at the same time. It would have had to have been an American League team. You would have had to have one at first base and one as a DH. But just imagine if they could have brought some of the excitement they had in college to the pros together as teammates. That would have been something. Now, going back to something that Kevin brought up about the 88 FLIR design, I think having no definitive border made it disconcerting to look at. Also, a lot of unused space on the back. And if you look at the picture of the Will Clark card, let's start with the back. Yeah, there is a lot of unused space there, and that was probably the downside of the design that FLIR had here, because they used that infographic at the bottom to help describe a player's tendencies, hitting day versus night, home versus road, same thing with pitching. You had an awful lot of unused space in the case of Will Clark, because by the time his 88 card came out, he only had 3 years of professional baseball, so you only have 4 stats lines on him. As opposed to, if you look back at 87 FLIR, which did the same thing, you had the infographic at the bottom, a guy like Kent Tekulve, who was our random pull. Well, he, by 1987, he had probably, I'd say, 14 or 15 pro years. So if you include different levels at the minor leagues, you know, he had about 20 lines of information, so it filled up the card a lot better. Now, as for the description of disconcerting to look at, that's how you see it. I don't know if it's disconcerting. It doesn't pop. And that's a term that we use in broadcasting and in entertainment, you know, something visual that just jumps out at you, stands out at you, just looks really sharp and clean and clear. It pops at you. And the Will Clark card doesn't pop at you. And a lot of the 88 FLIR cards don't. And as I mentioned in the podcast, 88 FLIR was a good set, but not great, but also not bad. It's not one where you go, it's just there. Not bad, not good. Just there. And that's pretty much how all these years later I look at 88 FLIR. And it's something that, you know, I did have quite a bit of a collection for. I actually, way back in college, I bought a box and just opened them up and tore them, you know, all those star cards out and rookie cards. So I have quite a few hanging around somewhere. But, at the same time, I had another 88 FLIR box I bought and I was hanging on to. I was going to sell it for big bucks one day. I think I broke even, if you're including the shipping. I just got it out of my house, along with several other wax boxes a few years ago. And that was just one of the reasons why. It was okay to collect, but it wasn't like, I've got to have more of this. You know, 87 Tops still has that allure to me. If I had the time and money to just go out and just buy these boxes and rip open into them, I would. 87 Tops definitely has that. 89 Tops, I'm getting the itch. I might do it. But 88 FLIR, not exactly. So thanks to everybody who chimed in this week on Wax and Gum Stains. Again, tell a friend about Wax and Gum Stains. The Twitter feed, tell them about Wax Ecstatic, the podcast, which comes your way every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom. And make sure you tell them about the opportunity to advertise here. Again, we're not looking to clutter this thing up with ads. Price points are low. We've got a very loyal audience. It is growing, and they know where to find us every Tuesday and Friday. And hopefully you, as an advertiser, as a listener, as a follower of the hobby, a collector of these little chunks of cardboard goodness that we still hang on to, even as adults, hopefully you're just as entertained as we come to you at least twice a week with these podcasts. All right, 88 Tops. This is an interesting set because I think the success of 87 Tops and the legend that is 87 Tops works against 88 Tops. And let's also keep in mind, too, that the 87 Tops set came after a rather lackluster, in my opinion, 86 set. So they get it right with this legendary set that has stars. It has rookies. It has a beautiful design. And even if you weren't born in 1987, you could have been born in 1967, 77, 97. Chances are, if you've collected cards, you've run across the 87 Tops set a lot. Well, 88 Tops is just lacking, well, that pop. It really is. It's a simple look. It's a clean look. But I think when you look at 88, and especially when you compare it to 87, you're going, well, that's nice. You know, again, it's kind of in the boat that FLIR is in. You know, the 88 FLIR set was okay, not great, not terrible, But okay, here it is. And that's certainly, I think, the case with 88 Tops. Let's take a look at our random pull card. Again, card number 430, Glenn Davis, then the first baseman of the Houston Astros. And, you know, it's a nice action shot here of Glenn about to take somebody yard. And I'm trying to identify the team that he's trying to do that with. Might be the Dodgers? Maybe the Mets. Probably the Mets. And there he is in the Astros rainbow goodness, sometime probably in the 1987 season, about to go yard. And the picture around a large white border and then a smaller inner border. And this is something that we've seen other companies do. In fact, we saw Score do it before. We've seen Topps would do it again in 1991. But here you go. You've got these two borders here and the inner border was color coordinated with the team, as was the team name, which was written right across the top. Nice big block letters over in the lower right hand corner in this angle, this kind of a wrapper, almost like a sash look, if you will. It has the player's name. And there you go. You know, no position. You just saw the player's name and his team up top. And here in the Glenn Davis example, it's a little obscured because his foot is on top of it. But other cards, I think it's a little cleaner. You've got the Topps logo. So again, clean, simple, pretty colorful. An action shot here. I know there were a lot of action shots in 88 Topps, but just lacking. And a lot of it, again, is because 87 Topps was so good, the 88 set, you're just going, okay. Now, the more I look at this, and as I mentioned before, I'm trying to come around to 88 Topps. I'm trying to like it. This is the ugly, shaggy dog of baseball cards, certainly from 1988. And 88 was not a very good year for cards, but you know, I'm trying to come around to it. I'm trying to like it. I'm trying to give this little puppy dog a big hug, even though it smells like a wet dog. But I still can't quite do it. I'm trying to convince myself. I'm trying to give it another chance. Can't you see what I'm doing? I'm trying to give you another chance. Because, you know, it's been almost 25 years here. I've seen this card many, 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 many times. And it does have some really good elements. Again, the photography, the color, the very clean design. It's not bad, but I'm still, I don't know. I'm still just not drawn to it. And maybe it's just me. I don't know. If you're drawn to it still all these years later, go ahead and comment at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Be curious to see what you have to say about it. But, you know, the design of the card just doesn't really grab me. And let's flip the card over. Let's take a look at that. The back here, we've got the orange juice look here. Yes, the Valencia orange back of 88 Topps. Glenn Davis, you've got the Topps logo. Again, on the back, Topps was a little insecure during this time of high, heavy competition in the card industry. They had their logo everywhere. Got the card number to the bottom of that over in the left corner. Player name, position, personal information along the top, along with a string of baseballs. And then beneath it, the usual Topps stuff. You've got the career stats. You've got some personal note. And then if there is a enough space for some random note about the player or maybe some kind of baseball trivia, that's where you would find it. The interesting thing here is that Glenn was signed as a draft selection from Scout Gerald Hunsinker, of course, better known as Jerry Hunsinker, who had a very, very long association with the Astros before becoming a special consultant to Andrew Friedman when he was a general manager of the Tampa Bay Rays. Of course, Friedman now, pretty good disciple under Hunsinker, working his magic over with the Dodgers in Los Angeles. But, you know, that was your basic Topps fare, and I think that pretty much describes the back of this card. Very, very basic. There's nothing spectacular here. You know, even the 1905 style finger here, you know, this way to the clubhouse. I guess you can call it a foam finger, but this reminds me a lot of advertising in the early 20th century, at least pictures of it that I've seen where you have, you know, the finger kind of pointing down to a door. Here's the dentist shop. So, you know, the back of the card is not spectacular. It's an odd color choice too, going with the orange, and especially with the gray cardboard stock the Topps was using back then. You know, the orange and gray, definitely unique, but not a great look. And I think that just kind of adds to the whole package of 88 Topps here. It is a unique card, but nothing that you go, wow. And of course, part of the problem is that much like every other card set that was released in 1988 and for the next several years, there was too much of it then, there's too much of it now, and you can find 88 Tops pretty much everywhere. Now, it doesn't quite get the bad reputation of Donruss. I mean, everyone thinks there's enough Donruss to, you know, pave every sidewalk in the world three times over. Still plenty of 88 Tops, and, you know, that's, again, part of the problem there is that there's just an overabundance of product. Also, in terms of rookies and star power, now you have all the stars from the 1980s in this set, but when it comes to rookies, really the one card that stands out is Tom Glavine. That was pretty much the big rookie. It's a card you could still value at a couple of dollars, depending what condition it's in, but it really lacks for super big name, big dollar rookie cards. So that's another tail off from 1987. No fault of Topps. I mean, that's just how the rookie class worked in 1988. So the lack of big name rookies, you've got second and third and fourth year cards for star players, and then just the overall blah design that kind of hampers 1988 Topps. Now, for me personally, another reason why I was never really big on this set was, and I've told this story before, where when I was a kid, I basically paid for my own baseball card collection, mostly through mowing neighbors' yards. But, you know, I just never really had a lot of disposable income as a kid. You know, at this time, I was 13, 14 years old collecting these cards. So a lot of the times, if I went to a card store, could I afford the 82 Tops? Could I afford the 85 Tops, the 81 Donruss? No, I couldn't. You know, I couldn't pay the $5, $6, $7 a pack for some of those quote-unquote vintage packs, even in 89, 90, 91, around there. But what I could afford was 88 Tops. You know, in 1988, it was, I believe, 45 cents a pack, and it was still pretty much 45 cents a pack in 89 and 90 and 91. You could probably get them for 25 cents a pack if you look hard enough. But, you know, I think that's part of it is that, you know, when I look back and see how I spent my money, instead of saving up a few dollars for those, you know, more valuable cards, those rarer cards, I was just buying pack after pack after pack. And it was a lot easier. If I had $5 in my hand, I was looking at value. I could get more than four or five. I could get 8 or 10 packs of 88 Tops as opposed to one pack of 85 Tops, or, you know, if I saved up $10, maybe I could get the 83 Tops pack. So I've always been more of the efficient guy. I've been the value guy. And when it comes to collecting cards in the late 1980s, that wasn't necessarily the best decision to make. So for me, there's always that personal drag. And I think that's part of what kind of brings down the 88 Tops set for me. I just can't rally around it. That's just how it goes. So 88 Tops, not one of my favorites from the 88 sets, Donruss, Fleer, Score, and Tops. It's probably the bottom one. You know, I really think when you look back at the 88 sets, I would have to say there's a tie between Score and Donruss in terms of design and just really nice look and availability. You know, Tops, 88 Tops just doesn't really have much of a legacy. The legacy behind it is it doesn't quite live up to 87. And the other legacy is if you ever are foolish enough to buy those packs with 20 vintage wax packs in it, and really only two of them are of value, 88 Tops, that's the one where they cram about six of them. You know, if you buy the wax pack or rack pack or cello pack lot that you see on eBay, get 5,000 cards for only $40. You know, there's 100 packs in there and 40 of them are 88 Tops. That's the legacy. It's the one set where you go, well, you know what? I can donate these. I'm really not going to miss them. So that's really the legacy that Tops leaves behind in 1988. Not all that different from Glenn Davis's legacy, which is unfortunate because he really was a great baseball player for a stretch of about five seasons. And then, well, injuries pretty much took him down, and being part of a rather lopsided trade, of course, doesn't help his situation. Now, he wasn't only signed by Jerry Hunsinker, as our 88 Tops card was very happy to point out, but also he was drafted, ironically, by the Baltimore Orioles 31st round of the 1979 amateur draft. He did not sign. He continued to go through school, and he kind of bounced around a little bit with schools. Middle Georgia College, the State College of Florida, and that's in Bradenton, just south of Tampa, and eventually settling into the University of Georgia. Well, he was doing very well at Georgia. The Houston Astros came around in the draft in 1981. This was the secondary draft, and as the back of the 88 card mentioned, he was signed by Jerry Hunsicker. Well, he was the fifth pick overall in that secondary draft. Very quickly moved his way up through the Astros system, making his major league debut September 2nd, 1984. And here was a guy who in 84, now granted only 18 games, didn't give you the impression he was going to be a star player because he only hit .213, two home runs, drove in eight runs, but clearly the Astros had something to believe in him because 1985, a breakout year for him, 100 games, 390 plate appearances, hit .271, 20 home runs, drove in 64 runs, finished fifth in the Rookie of the Year voting, and things only got better. 1986, a banner year for Davis and the Astros. Of course, they won the NL West that year, took the Mets pretty far, six games into the NLCS before, in the wee early morning hours after Game 6 started, 16th inning, I think it was, if I remember correctly, the Mets finally closed the door on the Stros. But Glenn Davis, quite possibly his best season, although you could argue 1989 was up there, but 86, 158 games played, 31 home runs, 101 RBI. He was an all-star. He was the runner-up in the National League MVP voting, and he was a silver slugger. By the way, 89, his other all-star season, 158 games played, .269 batting average, 34 home runs, only knocked in 89 runners. He actually finished seventh in the MVP race then, finished eighth in the MVP race in 1988. And, you know, in 1990, was dealing with some injuries, but still produced 93 games. He still hit .251, 22 home runs. So you're thinking this is a valuable commodity. The Baltimore Orioles, jilted at the altar before in the 1979 amateur draft, just had to have him. They had to pull him in here, and they wanted to trade for him. They wanted an upgrade at first base. A longtime first baseman Eddie Murray had moved on to the New York Mets. So the Baltimore Orioles, in January of 1991, make the following deal. They acquire him from the Houston Astros for three players. You ready for this? Steve Finley, Pete Harnisch, and Curt Schilling. Ooh, if they only knew then what we know now. So Steve Finley, let's very quickly go through just some of the highlights from his career. He was a pretty good outfielder, would win a World Series in 2001 with the Arizona Diamondbacks, also appeared in a World Series in 1998 with the San Diego Padres. So there's a guy who picks up a World Series ring in 2001, had a very lengthy career, 19 seasons in the big leagues, a .271 batting average over that time, 304 home runs as well. Next up, Pete Harnisch, who is not quite as celebrated as some of the other players there, but he had a pretty good career as well. 14 years as a pitcher, 111 wins, 103 losses, 3.89 earned run average. And this is a guy who was able to make a pretty good career, not only in Houston, but during the Mets resurgence in the mid-90s, and then later on with Milwaukee and Cincinnati. And then the big name, of course, Curt Schilling. Everyone knows Curt Schilling's story, and this is before he went off the deep end with his political rants. And I don't care what political party you side with, but Curt Schilling has just gone off the rails. I don't know what planet he is on right now, but unfortunately, people listen to him. So he won a World Series with Arizona, two World Series with Boston in 2004 and 2007, and despite allegations of possibly dealing with the needle in his career, 216 wins in his career, 3.46 earned run average. And again, a guy who a lot of players gravitated around during those World Series runs. As for Glenn Davis, let's look at his end of the deal. Played only 49 games in 1991. He was injured, batted .227, 10 home runs. He actually became a free agent. couldn't find a home, so the Orioles re-signed him in 1992, had his best season with the Orioles in 92, playing 106 games, 276 batting average, and 13 home runs, and then the bottom dropped out in 93, appeared in just 30 games, batted 177, only one home run. Of course, by then, Finley and Harnish and Schilling are starting to take off in Houston, and fans knew back then that it was just a terrible deal. Signed as a free agent with the New York Mets in 1994, did not make the team, so basically his career ended May 23rd, 1993, as injuries just absolutely robbed him. Now, while Baltimore Orioles fans are very upset about that trade, much like when a player signs a big-dollar contract somewhere and doesn't pan out, well, you know what? You can't always blame the player here. It's not like Glenn Davis wanted to go to Baltimore. In fact, John McMullen, who was the owner of the Houston Astros in 91, when the trade was done, he was just blowing up the shop. You know, he was just starting from square one and would bring in a lot of young players to build a team that was pretty good in the mid-1990s. You know, going through the whole rebuild process, Glenn Davis was part of it. Had a few good years in the mid to late 80s. Got kicked out in 1991. It's unfortunate that Davis kind of gets tagged with this reputation as being part of one of the worst trades in certainly Orioles history. I won't go as far as to say baseball history. I think there are far worse than that, but he certainly gets lumped into that group. And hey, it's no fault of his own. He got traded. Injuries just took over his life, and that was that. Now, Glenn Davis has moved on to some rather good things after his pro career. In fact, while he was wrapping up his career, he founded The Carpenter's Way. That's a home for disadvantaged children in Columbus, Georgia. And by the way, Glenn Davis is originally from Jacksonville, which is not that far from Columbus, Georgia. And he is also the CEO of the Cascade Group, which develops hotels in the Southeast. So there is a chance that you have stayed in the Hilton Garden Inn in Columbus, Georgia. Glenn Davis is the manager of the group that owns that hotel and several others, again, throughout primarily the Southeast. So Glenn Davis, who in an article that I read about him from the Columbus Ledger, here's a guy who certainly knew his way around hotels as a professional ball player. He decided to get into the business, and it is a very lucrative business for him and his family. So Glenn Davis wins out in the end. He was part of a bad trade. Injuries robbed his professional career. He really could have been remembered as one of the biggest slugging first basemen for probably another 5 to 8 years had he not just had injuries ravage his body. That wasn't the case, so he turns things around in his personal life and has become a very, very successful hotel operator. And again, the charity, The Carpenter's Way, helping out kids in the Columbus, Georgia area. So there you go, Glenn Davis turning things around off the field. And I'm trying to turn things around with 88 tops in my life, but again, can't do it. I don't know. Maybe in time I'll eventually come around to it, but it's hard to say. Again, you're more than welcome to comment about 88 Tops or Glenn Davis on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And that'll wrap up 1988. We turn to 1989, a much better year for most of the car companies, save Score. We'll get to them eventually. But we've got another new kid on the block. And this one would turn the hobby on its ear. We look at 1989 Upper Deck in our next podcast. It's coming your way this Friday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic.